published. We're talking private business. Okay, I will call the special meeting of the Monterey Bay Air Resources District Advisory Committee meeting to order. Would you take a roll call?
Yes, I will. Let's see, Chair Brennan.
Here.
Committee Member Copeland.
Here.
Committee Member Hatchett.
Here.
Thank you.
Can't hear you, Siri.
Am I not coming through?
No, Siri's sound went off.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Oh. Okay, I will continue. Committee Member McClooney.
Present.
Why am I? Okay, thank you. Committee Member Smith.
Here.
Committee Member Andreessen.
Here.
Thank you. Committee Member Mack. Absent. Committee Member Storm. Absent. Committee Member Turley.
Here.
Thank you. Committee Member Swint. Committee Member Stroh, absent. Committee Member Rock, absent. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There are 7 present, you have quorum.
Thank you. The first item on the agenda is to receive the report on the status of AB 361. It recommends, Rich, do you have any comments?
Yeah, most of you know the drill, but this body has to make a determination that the conditions to use the provisions of AB 361 are still in effect. And those provisions are that there's a proclamation by the governor of state of emergency due to the COVID-19 outbreak. And then we also have the Monterey County health officer recommending that all public meetings observe social distancing and other precautions. So that satisfies the requirements of AB 361. And this body needs to approve that to move forward so we can meet through this teleconference Zoom meeting.
Are there any questions from the committee? Any comments from the public? If not, a motion is in order to approve the requirements of AB 361.
I'll move that we approve the AB 61.
And I'll second it.
Thank you. It's been moved and seconded to approve the requirements of AB 361. Any discussion? If not, would you take a roll call vote, please? A roll call vote, Siri?
Hey, Siri? Okay, I'll go next door.
Yeah, you're frozen, so I don't know.
While I have this opportunity, can I request any staff in-house to go off video so that we're not taxing our, thank you, Amy. We've got some bandwidth problems sometimes. David, too. You'll come back on for your presentation, David. Maybe I'll go off. Okay, so let's wait for Siri to rejoin us. Sorry about this. This is always problematic. I'll be talking about the continuation of this in our next meeting, which is right after this one ends.
Can we do it from your office?
Oh, yeah, come on in.
Sorry, we have no internet in my office. Okay, I will take the roll call for the motion first by Copeland and then seconded by Smith. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you. Turley?
Yes.
Thank you. McClooney?
Yes.
Committee Member Hatchett?
Yes.
Committee Member Copeland?
Yes.
Chair Brennan?
Yes.
Committee Member Andreessen?
Yes.
Let's see. One. Approve unanimously. Thank you.
You should have David and Amy drop off the video so that might make it easier.
Rich, it's my understanding from County Council that the governor's emergency order will end in February, and after that, we're going to have to meet in, or get to meet in person. Have you heard anything like that?
Exactly right. And our county council, you know, less. So that's what he's saying. However, you know, there are some provisions in the new law to allow people to participate remotely, but they're pretty arduous. You'd have to give a notice in advance and let the public know the reason why you can't make it. And then the full board in advance has to agree to have you participate remotely. Those combination of events seem rather unlikely for most people. So we'll probably be seeing each other in person the next meeting, and we'll have snacks for you, and you can observe whatever you need to with respect. I see Caitlin, you've got your mask on, so we'll have masks and you can sit in a far part of the room or what have you. That is, if the governor doesn't, you know, because COVID might start up again, so that could all go back into effect.
Okay, thank you. The next item to is accept and file summary of actions for the advisory committee special meeting of September 1. Are there any comments or questions on that? If not, we will accept the summary and we will adjourn the meeting. And we will go to the regular meeting of December 1. My dog is here barking and I can't let him outside because it's raining. would you take a roll call vote for the regular meeting?
Siri's back on yet?
Doesn't seem to be.
She's right next door. Go get her.
Get you a new computer or something. Okay, did you go ahead? She's starting to move. So we're taking a roll call for the news.
Okay, and what time did the meeting start? I'll check.
Yeah, 2 minutes ago.
Okay, I'm sorry about this. All right, the roll call for the regular advisory committee meeting is right here. Okay, committee member Andreessen.
Here.
Thank you. Chair Brennan.
Here.
Committee Member Copeland.
Here.
Committee Member Hatchett.
Here.
Committee Member Mack. Absent. Committee Member McClooney.
Present.
Committee Member Rock. She said she might be late. Committee Member Smith.
Here.
Thank you. Committee Member Storm. Absent. Committee Member Stroh. Absent. Committee Member Swint, absent. Committee Member Turley.
Here.
Thank you. We have quorum.
Thank you. Rich, are there any changes to the agenda?
No changes.
Thank you. And now's the time for comments from the public on items not on the agenda. Do we have any members of the public present?
Nothing received at the district office.
Thank you. The next item is accept and file summary of actions of the advisory committee meeting of September 1, 2022. Are there any comments on the minutes? Any comments from the public? If not, we will accept the minutes as presented. So our next item is a presentation on climate action plans. David Frisbee?
Yes, I'd like to introduce Amory Bertro from AMBAG. He's the Sustainability Program Manager. He's graciously accepted an invitation to discuss what their activities have been on climate action planning in the district. And this was a request from your committee to find out more about what's going on with climate action planning. So thank you for being here, Amory. I'll turn it over to you.
Great, and thank you so much for having me. And I'm gonna start sharing my screen and share a brief presentation for you all. So I'll be just discussing the state of climate action planning in the Monterey Bay and really the different efforts that the cities have got going on, where they're at, and just giving you a brief overview of what is a climate action plan, what are they trying to achieve. So AMBAG is the Metropolitan Planning Organization for Monterey, San Benito, and Santa Cruz, as well as the Council of Government for Monterey and Santa Cruz counties. We create the Metropolitan Transportation Plan and Sustainable Community Strategies every 4 years. And really, we're trying to link transportation, land use, housing in order to enhance sustainable mobility, reduce per capita transportation GHG emissions. Now, my role at AMBAG, I'm the Sustainability Program Manager. I implement a number of sustainability initiatives in order to build capacity for communities to reduce GHG emissions and build resiliency to climate change. So we run different energy efficiency programs, different planning efforts relating to natural and working lands, relating to EVs, really trying to help the communities to fight climate change. As part of these efforts, we prepared GHG inventories, greenhouse gas inventories, for all 21 AMBAG jurisdictions in 2005, 2010, and 2015. And then we also received funding from Central Coast Community Energy to prepare 2018, 2019, and 2020 community-wide GHG emissions for all inventories for all 3C members as they started to receive electricity. And so all of these projects are now complete, and we've provided jurisdictional staff with all these inventories. Now, before I dive a little bit deeper, just to give you some background terms that we use, a baseline year is the year against which we track emissions. When we talk about greenhouse gas emissions and GHGs, we really talk about three main gases: carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide. And then all of these get expressed in carbon dioxide equivalent so that we can report out one number when we talk about climate action planning, when we talk about GHG inventories. When we talk about community-wide greenhouse gas inventories, really we're trying to look at a community and calculate the emissions that are generated as a result of their activities, whether they occur within the boundaries of that community or whether they occur outside of the boundaries of the geographical boundaries of the community, but as a direct result of their activities. And then finally, when we talk about a climate action plan, it's really a document that details the different GHG reduction measures that would need to be implemented in order for a community to meet a GHG reduction goal. So I always like to remind folks of the targets. The 2020 targets that we had was to return to 1990 levels. And that was AB 32. Then we had SB 32, which was a 40% reduction from the 1990 level. And then this year, AB 1279 passed. And there, the goal is to reduce emissions 85% from the 1990 levels. AB 1279 also has a goal of carbon neutrality. So that means that you have to reduce emissions 85%. And then for that remainder of 15%, either you have to reduce it further or you have to implement measures that would sequester carbon and have negative emissions so that once everything is tallied out, you're at zero or below. because most jurisdictions don't have a 1990 inventory, they use an equivalency with 2005, because that's when most cities were able to first start doing greenhouse gas inventories. And so the equivalency is that in 2005, emissions were roughly 15% higher than 1990 emissions. And so that means that the 2020 target was a 15% reduction from a 2005 baseline year. The 2030 target is about a 50% reduction. And then the 2045 target is an 87% reduction. And so most cities will then use 2005 to track their efforts when they do climate action plans. Now, in order to complete a climate action plan, there's several steps. The first one is to complete a greenhouse gas inventory. Then there's quite a bit of forecasting that needs to go in. So business as usual forecast, and then adjustment to that forecast for all the different statewide mandates, which would reduce emissions. And then once you know where you stand, that's when you would identify the GHG reduction still required to meet the statewide GHG reduction targets. And then you would identify and draft GHG reduction measures. Because I know folks like more visual example, what you're seeing here is the blue line is the business as usual forecast. So this is just population, housing, and employment growth and the emissions if they just grew along those factors. Then the light gray line is what would happen with all the different mandates that the state has already put in place. We know that there's several mandates like the light electric vehicle mandate that all new sales be electric vehicles by 2035. So you tally all of that. And the dark gray line is the targets, so where you need to be. And really the GHG climate action plan really is about that sort of bracket that you see here. It's how do you create local measures that go from that light gray line of the adjusted BAU forecast all the way down to meeting the targets. And then, of course, because we have that carbon neutrality target, again, some plans, some climate action plan now may need to include sequestration measures in order to meet that 2045 target. Now, once measures have been drafted, you conduct a deep public engagement process to identify the needs of the community and what measures make sense to them. You finalize the GHG reduction measures, ideally identifying implementation and monitoring requirements. You create the draft plans, receive the public comments. If the plan will be qualified under CEQA as a plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, you would obtain CEQA certification. Not all plans seek that certification. So in the region, we've had some plans that are CEQA certified plans, some plans that are not. And then finally, you would adopt the climate action plan. Now, in our region, we've had quite a bit of activity in this space. And so AMBAG, after creating the greenhouse gas inventories, we meet with the jurisdictions, we talk to them about what their objectives are. When they onboard a consultant to do a climate action plan, we give all of the data we created, all the greenhouse gas inventories, over to the consultants. And really, we try to work as closely as possible with the jurisdictions to connect them with other jurisdictions that have climate action plans, to give them measures that other folks have used, really trying to make this as collaborative as we can. So in the region, we've had the City of Capitola, Carmel, Gonzales, City of Monterey, City of Santa Cruz, City of Watsonville, and County of Santa Cruz have adopted caps. And that means that the caps are finalized. In some cases, like the City of Gonzales, they've actually updated their cap already once. Same thing with the City of Santa Cruz and the City of Watsonville. So they had an initial cap with a 2020 target, and they've now created a new cap that has a 2030 target in the case of City of Santa Cruz and Watsonville. Gonzales still has a 2020 cap. We also have jurisdictions that are in the process of creating climate action plans or updating climate action plans, and that's the City of Hollister, the City of Salinas, and the County of Monterey, and the County of Santa Cruz. So they're really going through that process of doing community engagement, drafting the measures, really getting an understanding of what is it going to take in order to meet that 2030 goal is really what those climate action plans are currently focused on. Now, I think what I want to leave you all with is that implementation really is key to successfully planning for climate change. And in the past, especially with the earlier climate action plans, jurisdictions really struggled with how to implement the plans. partly due to a lack of funding and due to a lack of staff capacity, it's been quite difficult for them to understand what their role is in the space, whether it's to create pilot programs, to create programs, is it to be doing education and outreach to the community, to let their communities about all the programs that already exist. So I think at this stage, all the jurisdictions that have created climate action plans and the one that are updating them, there's really a groundswell of interest. And we've seen a lot of jurisdictions really wanting to partner with one another, with regional agencies, with community partners to implement the climate action plans by going after grants, by trying to stand up programs, by doing education and outreach. So really this is a very active space right now. And definitely we've seen your guys' leadership in supporting them with the different programs that you run. So that's very much appreciated. That's my presentation today. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Are there questions from the committee? Well, I have a few questions. Is there a state mandate to require jurisdictions to prepare CAPs?
So there is not a state mandate specifically requiring jurisdictions to create climate action plans. What there is as part of a comprehensive general plan update, there is a mandate to consider GHG emissions. And so what we've seen is quite a few jurisdictions that have been doing climate action plans have been doing them as a mitigation measure to their general plan EIR. That requirement can also be met with a more traditional EIR analysis. The climate action plans have been done on more ad hoc basis. Some of them for that purpose of the general plan, some of them because jurisdictions wanted to show leadership on climate action and wanted a plan that they could then take and, for example, be more competitive with or grants with.
In terms of CEQA, just for information for the committee, if a jurisdiction has a cap that accommodates greenhouse gas emissions into the future and a project is included in those forecasts, then that helps streamline the process. My question is, who certifies the cap for CEQA?
The way that it works is that there's really a few consulting firms that throughout California are the ones doing climate action plans, and they're really the consultants are really the one working with the cities in order to go through the CEQA process.
Well, you said that the plans had to be certified for CEQA process. So, who certifies them?
So usually it's just like a normal CEQA process, either it's notices that there's been no adverse impact or negative declaration or a mitigated negative declaration. Very rarely do we see full-blown EIRs for climate action plans. Again, if it's done as part of a general plan update, then it would be the certification would happen as part of the general plan EIR. So again, it depends in what circumstance the climate action plan is being created.
Okay, in terms of those jurisdictions preparing CAPs, I know Carmel and Monterey, City of Carmel and City of Monterey are currently preparing CAPs and those haven't been approved. Are those updates to existing CAPs?
So the City of Carmel, I believe, has now approved their climate and action and adaptation plan. That one is not CEQA certified. I am not aware of the City of Monterey currently being updating their climate action plan. The County of Monterey is the one that is currently building their first climate action plan.
Okay. Couple other questions. I know part of the difficulty with AMBAG's greenhouse gas emission inventory is that it doesn't account for in commute and out commute of motor vehicles, which is kind of a problem for local jurisdictions in terms of addressing greenhouse gas emission. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, so in 2020, AMBAG shifted the methodology that we use, and we now use a household-based allocation in order to allocate the full MFAC emissions for each county. The greenhouse gas inventories that we prepare are meant to be regular inventories that use the exact same methodologies across all jurisdictions so that these inventories can be compared to one another. That is a very different exercise than what you need to do in order to get to a climate action plan, or it is a slightly different exercise. And that's because each jurisdiction might wish to customize their greenhouse gas inventories as they're building their climate action plan. So for example, if they're doing it as part of a general plan update, they would be maybe looking at different growth assumptions because they would have to take into account the projected growth of the general plan. Same thing with, they would have to look at their traffic element and see if the VMT numbers and how those play out. So what we always say is we provide the data to the consultant, we provide our growth forecast to the consultant that AMBAG prepare, and then we tell the consultant, ask us any questions that you have and feel free to make any modification that you need to the greenhouse gas inventory so that it fits the needs of the city. We're really not in the business of creating the climate action plan for the jurisdictions. And so really it's up to the jurisdictions and the consultants to determine how best to use the data that we provide.
Okay, thank you. And a question for David, what is the role of the district in terms of reviewing greenhouse gas or the CAPS?
So if a city or a jurisdiction has a qualified, CEQA qualified climate action plan, then if the proposed project is meeting the requirements of the plan, then they're not going to be considered a significant effect on the environment. So it's a much easier way to review a project because there are these qualifications that are laid out.
Does a district review CAPS for CEQA consistency?
We do not.
Okay.
Chair, I have a question.
Yes, Matthew.
Thank you for the presentation. Answered this maybe at the start of your presentation, but you mentioned how this covers within emissions within the jurisdiction. Are you seeing any way the jurisdictions are trying to tackle emissions that come from outside the jurisdiction? And that mainly I'm thinking about wildfire impacts and just how those are a completely different scale, it seems. I'm no scientist for sure. But, you know, are there ways that you're seeing some of these climate action plans try to tackle emissions coming from outside the jurisdiction?
Yeah, so quite a few of the emissions that are accounted for in the climate action plans actually do not occur within the geographical boundaries of the city. A good example would be solid waste. The waste is generated within the city, but then it gets sent to a landfill, and then the emissions actually occur at the landfill. By the same way of transportation, when they really try to account for the traffic pattern of the community, which some of it occurs within the city boundaries, some of it does not. Same thing with like electricity, we use it in the jurisdiction, right? But then it's not being actually generated in the jurisdiction. So really, again, the goal of the community inventory is to track the activities of the community. Now, in terms of the wildfire question, that's a very interesting one. There is a whole set of emissions that are called biogenic emissions that are typically not included in the inventories because they are a result essentially of natural processes. And for example, when we look at the CZU, it wouldn't be appropriate to be assigning to the county of unincorporated county of Santa Cruz, let's say, all of the emissions from the wildfire, because they're really, the community really isn't generating those emissions. These are emissions that are happening as a result of a natural event. So these emissions typically are not included.
And does that also include, for example, those wildfires that burned houses and non-natural fuel as part of the event?
Right. Typically, emissions from natural disasters are not included.
Got it. Thank you.
Lacey, you have your hand up.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I do have a question, and I apologize. I had a conflict at the beginning of the meeting, so I missed a lot of your first slides, but it's good to see you, Amaury, and thank you for your time. The question I have is maybe a little bit for staff and a little bit for our presenter, but I'm curious because at a statewide level, the Air Resources Board really seems to have a high level of involvement with meeting some of our state's emissions targets and climate change goals. But we don't seem to have as much involvement at a local level. And I'm just curious if that's true or if I'm misunderstanding that, and why not do we have as much of a direct involvement in supporting climate action planning and climate change mitigation measures?
Rich, do you want to address that one?
Sure. Let me put my video on. Hopefully I won't crash everything. Okay, so that's a really great question. And, from a business perspective, this sounds like a cop-out, but there really aren't any monies for us to do a lot of the reviews that take place. So we have to figure out ways to pay for that type of work. But probably the largest issue is that just because of what you said, Lacey, CARB is actually doing lion's share of the work, cap and trade and so forth. And they have actually gotten into lawsuits with local districts that have wanted to regulate CO2 emissions. They feel that it's sort of a top-down approach. So having everybody sort of reinvent the wheel underneath is not very helpful to them. But, we have put on, for instance, on our sources, our industrial sources, we have adopted greenhouse gas thresholds for those. It's sort of a paper tiger. Primarily the main reason is CARB does not want us to get into this business. They want us to continue regulating pollutants, criteria pollutants and toxics at stationary sources. And then the other major factor is a lot of these, if you look at the distribution of where most of the carbon's coming from, it's from the transportation and energy sectors. And, we don't have any regulatory authority over the transportation sector, although we do have fairly active programs with reducing emissions through building infrastructure for EVs and for other types of programs, including hydrogen fuel. So we're trying to branch out in those areas where we don't have regulatory authority and we get money through the state. So those monies come down to us in the form of grant funds to implement those programs. So yeah, the authority issue and then who pays for it is an issue. And then I'll just say finally, we've seen a lot of jurisdictions because of a lack of coordination from the top that actually double dip when they take emission reduction credits, for instance. I know when the cement plant in Davenport shut down, we had about four folks developing climate action plans taking credit for the emissions reductions for that facility. So it sort of makes sense on that somebody would be overseeing that from a top-down approach. And if CARB is like most programs, if they want us to do additional work for them, which they haven't said that yet, we would just say, yeah, we're happy to do that as long as you show us how we can pay for that. But they don't want us taxing. This was an issue with the Bay Area. The Bay Area was going out with fees on carbon, and the state blew a gasket over that. They said they had no authority to do that. And so they got in a pretty bitter lawsuit with one another over that issue, and the state finally prevailed. So, good question, but we would be happy to do the work if we had a way to pay for it.
Gotcha, okay, thank you, that's helpful.
One note I would like to add about the county's effort. 19% of the county's greenhouse gas emissions come from agriculture and primarily fertilizer use. And so the county has a really difficult time reaching its goals because it really doesn't have much regulatory authority over ag use. And that is becoming a real challenge for the county in preparing its cap. So just a note of interest, unlike all the other jurisdictions where the largest part is generally vehicle use, a large part of the county is from agricultural operations. So.
And Janet, along those lines, the ag folks have also been arguing to us and others, anybody who'll listen, that they have, pretty significant sequestration of carbon as well in growing crops. So, there's transportation related to that as well, which is definitely a deficit to the equation. But I could see, they're trying to position themselves as stewards of the land and all that. So we've heard it all before, but that's a good point that ag is fairly unregulated and they certainly don't want to have any additional regulation imposed upon them. And they've got a good lobby in capital as well.
Well, and one of the issues is that, there are programs for sequestration and agriculture, but the problem is first the data are hard to either verify, estimate, and enforce. So the effort at sequestration of ag emissions is really controversial. So,
and MBAG, in order to address partly this issue, we are working on a Monterey Bay Natural and Working Lands Climate Mitigation and Resiliency Study. With the objective of doing an inventory of the carbon stored in our natural and working lands and identifying potential mitigation and adaptation measures that could be implemented, we recognize that there is a lot of interest in this space of what are called climate smart solutions. And we think it's especially in our region, it's an area of great potential. If we can get the different stakeholders like the Resource Conservation District, the ag industry, really to work together and better understand where are the measures that could be implemented that could have real benefit.
Well, that's a very good presentation and responses to questions and comments. So thank you very much.
There are two hands up.
Sure. Okay, Eric.
I guess as far as, I guess I have two questions and I know I'm hogging. The first is, I guess for the county plan, it sounds like that excludes the communities that already have caps, right? So for example, Salinas and Monterey County are doing them at the same time. Is the county only like unincorporated land?
Yes.
And if that is the case, then does that include any areas that are, do not have caps in place? So
yeah. the county plan is only for unincorporated areas. Okay. They are doing it again as a mitigation measure for their 2010 general plan.
Yeah. And then as far as the ag emissions go, I find that really interesting. Are there any models or like any, I guess, easy wins in terms of alternatives to, like, you can't just say don't use fertilizer, right?
Right. There's a number of different things. What's interesting with the ag specifically is that you really have emissions, which are your fertilizer use, and then methane and nitrous oxide for manure decomposition. Mm-hmm. Those are emissions. And those are done as part of a climate action plan. They're entirely separate from sequestration, because sequestration involves calculating how much carbon is in the soil and then what different practices could be implemented to augment the amount of carbon in the soil, let's say. And so those two things have to be sort of done almost separately. And I know that I work pretty closely with the County of Monterey staff. That is analysis that is ongoing, where they do want to have some of those sequestration measures. So maybe they'll have trouble reducing the emissions, but then by the same token, they can highlight some measures that would actually have negative emissions.
Does sequestration, I guess, balance out in that way, though? Like it's, you said that if you're emitting methane and then sequestering carbon, it seems like this is a totally different part of the cycle.
Right. So the state targets, right, AB 1279 is an 85% reduction by 2045. That means no matter what, jurisdictions will have to reduce emissions 85%. And then again, that remaining 15%, that's what could come from that carbon sequestration.
Yeah.
So looking at the scoping plan and the different things, there's really a lot of interest in the potential for sequestration, because folks understand that once you get to that remaining 15%, it can be extremely hard to reduce emissions down to zero.
Are there any interesting, changes in processes that you would advocate for agriculture, or, you know, like people could advocate in general, to reduce those emissions without needing to maybe put too much of a burden on them?
I think that we've seen really leadership in our region, especially from the wine industry. They've implemented some really interesting cropping strategies, cover cropping strategies, different types of things. So there's definitely a lot of things that can be done. It really is a matter of not burdening the ag industry with sort of an extra layer of things they have to do, but really understanding how can these beneficial practices really fit in with their bottom line and really building those partnerships.
Awesome. Thank you.
Before going on to Lacey, there have been some pilot projects related to sequestration of emissions from ag, but they're very, very small. They're very hard to quantify, both in terms of reductions and in terms of monitoring. So it's a complex area. Lacey?
Well, just to respond to that example, SLO County, I believe, has done quite a bit of work and research into the application of different manures, I believe, and improving sequestration in some of the pasture land that they have for cattle. And I think folks up in the Bay Area, maybe Sonoma County, have also sort of been leading the way in this, so that those might be the examples you're referring to. And I think UCSC is doing some pretty innovative research around regenerative farming, which might not be at the scale yet that some of our larger ag industry folks would be, you know, willing to do, but that's gaining momentum in certain areas, I think, of the farming world. But my question is kind of going back to something Matt said, and it's more of a comment or an observation regarding fires, and because that does seem to be something that the Air Resource Board sort of monitors and looks for, and, you know, how's air quality when there's fires and how that figures into climate change and who's responsible for those emissions that come from fires. And my understanding, based on your response, Amory, and just general awareness, is that that's not, it's sort of a, these are the number of emissions from forest fires, and it's not attributed to any one entity. But I'd be curious if that changes in the future, because if we know, for example, that a spark from a power line that's managed by PG&E ignites the fire, is that their fault, quote unquote? Or if we know that controlled burns help to reduce the likelihood of these massive fires that get so out of control and burn so fiercely, if there is an entity within a jurisdiction that has control over a land, like maybe a significant portion of Fort Ord or something that should be managed but isn't, and then leads to sort of a massive fire event, I'd be curious how that might change in the future. And it's a comment, so nobody has to respond, but if anybody does know if that's being discussed, I'd be curious.
Okay, I just have one final note in terms of effectiveness of measures. Some of the most effective measures are changing the natural gas infrastructure to electrification, and electrification of vehicles, which the district is certainly involved in, and land use patterns that encourage job housing balance within communities and limit commuting. So in terms of effective emission reductions, and the ones the most accessible to cities in the county are those. And some of them are less painful than other kind of programs. So are there any other comments, questions? If not, thank you very much for the presentation. And
thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Right. The next is a presentation on the Carmel Valley Air Monitoring Station. Is that David?
Yes. David, are you on?
We have the slide, but can't hear David. You're muted, David.
Yes. Yeah.
You're in trouble on mute.
Okay. I'll just.
Am I muted now?
Yes.
Yeah. There you go.
Okay. Great. Okay. Today we're going to discuss the Carmel Valley Air Monitoring Station, some challenges we've been having with the station recently. So as you know, the Air District operates 7 air monitoring stations throughout the region to meet our obligations to consistently measure for the criteria pollutants. There's an additional 8th monitor in the Pinnacles National Park that's operated by the National Park Service. But today we're going to talk about specifically Carmel Valley Air Monitoring Station. Carmel Valley Air Monitoring Station is located at the Tularcitos School in Carmel Valley Village. That station monitors ozone, PM2.5, and we have got some MET data that we collect, wind speed, wind direction, and temperature. So it's represented by this green dot here in Carmel Valley. This is the outside of the station. As you can see, it's a shed that houses the air monitoring equipment. The sample ports are located outside of the shed. And this is a view of the inside. You can see it's the air monitoring equipment in the equipment rack. So two trees are encroaching on the station. Trees can cause an ozone scrubbing effect. So it would reduce the ozone that would be measured if it's influencing the ozone inlet. So EPA requires that the ozone inlet is at least 10 meters away from the closest branch on the closest tree. And there's a 2-for-1 requirement. The tree can't be 2 times taller than the distance from the inlet. And in this case, it's approximately less than a 36 degree angle to the top of the tree is what we're required to have. So with one of the trees, we've operated under a waiver since 2012, since it's offset from the prevailing winds. The wind's only coming from the direction of that particular tree 3% of the time. So we do have a waiver for that one. But we recently received during an audit a corrective action notification for the second tree. We don't have a possibility of a waiver because the prevailing wind direction is majority of the time the wind is coming from the direction of that tree that's starting to encroach on the station. And because the trees are so large, they can't be trimmed any further. So we must move the station or our data that we collect is going to be determined to be invalid. So this is the corrective active notification itself describes the action that's caused the notification. So we've got to be, the drip line essentially is the branch. And so we're less than 10 meters away. So We've got to do something about it. This is an picture of an overview of the station. Station's in the center here. Our south, the tree to the south, is the one with the waiver. And the problem tree is to the west. This is a picture was taken during the winter, so we don't have any leaves on the trees, but you can see that they are getting to be rather large and starting to encroach on the station. These are the two trees in relation to the station. This one here is the tree that we have the waiver for, and this is the one that's starting to encroach.
No.
Or is it the opposite?
No, it's the opposite.
Sorry. This tree, this tree on the left is the one that we have the waiver for. And so this is the tree with the EPA waiver, and this is the tree with the encroaching tree. So you can see the to find a new location, we've got many challenges. There's siting requirements from EPA and CARB. We've got power, need to make sure we have power available, adequate space and security, and access by staff, easily accessed by staff. We've got to go into a rental agreement with the landowner, and then there's costs associated with it. Essentially, we need to get a new building out there at the new site, or we'll have to find an alternative instrument that can have a smaller footprint. So we're looking at right now is a proposing location down at Carmel Valley Middle School, which is further down the valley towards Carmel by the sea. And with that, I'm happy to answer any of your questions.
Are there questions? Lacey.
It's not a question, it's just a little bit of a surprise. I thought this was going to be going towards, we have to cut down this tree. But for once, we're moving to accommodate a tree. That's
yeah, it's owned by the schools, and I don't think the school, this couple of trees, they don't want to cut down. It took a long time for those trees to grow, and
it's
certainly not our land.
Well, and they help improve our air quality, right? So
absolutely.
David, have you looked at the fire station in fairly close to the existing site?
We're starting to investigate these locations now.
Yeah. Well, it seemed the fire station, my recollection is there may be a location there. I know that people have looked at the fire station to put up poles for a Wi-Fi, but you might consider looking at that area.
Okay. Yeah, we'll take a look at that. Among many areas in the valley, there's very limited number of opportunities in the valley, so we'll investigate all those. And there might be an easier way by getting a different type of instrument that can be on a smaller footprint.
Well, the other thing is the valley has not had any ozone exceedances for quite a long time. So that's a point of consideration as well. Mm-hmm. Okay. If there are no other comments on that presentation, thank you. The next presentation is on the Electric Vehicle Incentive Program and Electric Bicycle Incentive Program. I guess that's David again.
You get me again. All right, let's see, get started. Okay, can you see the screen, the presentation?
Yes. All right.
So yeah, last meeting you requested, the advisory committee requested a overview of the, in summary of the electric vehicle and electric bike program. So that's what I present to you today. Electric vehicle incentive program incentivizes the purchase of electric vehicles and bicycles. the last couple of years, we've had $400,000 budgeted for 21-22 and $350,000 budgeted for 22-23, that's this year, and $50,000 for each year for electric bicycle program. This is the first 2 years that we've done electric bike program. You can see in these two different columns that we've got different incentives between the years. So for example, in a new battery electric vehicle in 2021 would receive a incentive of $1,500. And this year we had bumped it up to $2,000. For electric bicycles last year, there was a $1,000 incentive, but the program was only for low income applicants. This year we opened it up to applicants other than low income at $500. And then for all the programs, the incentive amounts were doubled for low income applicants. So the electric vehicle incentive program, we had 400, as of end of October, when we did this analysis, we had a total of 442 total applicants for both periods. As at the time, we had 711,000 awarded total for the programs, and low income was about 136,000. So between years 22 and 23, we actually, low income applicants doubled. We've got a lot more interest from low income applicants. By county, if you look at the awards by county, this is just for the electric vehicle program. We've got Monterey County in 2021-22 actually outpacing Santa Cruz. And then it reversed this year, where Santa Cruz County is actually outpacing Monterey. And San Benito has a lot less activity we're finding in these programs. As far as the incentive categories goes, we have, by and large, you can see the largest piece of the pie is from the new battery electric vehicles. So all electric vehicles are getting most of the attention. And then the next level is the used battery electric. So, you can see that in a positive way, we're actually reducing we're not incentivizing as much any of the gasoline powered vehicles. Interestingly enough, we did have some interest from hydrogen fuel cell, even though we don't have any fueling stations in the region. So these are people that are commuting to the Bay Area to fuel up. Just a breakdown of some of the models, the top five models that are of interest. For each year, we've got in 21-22, we had Teslas at the top two. And then this year fiscal year, we had Chevy Bolt and then the Ford Mach-E number two. Ford Mach-E was just introduced this year, so we wouldn't have seen it last year. And Teslas are actually getting phased out because the California Vehicle Rebate Project, which is what we base the vehicle eligibility on, has phased out the Teslas because they're too expensive now. They've passed that threshold. So incentives aren't going to be available for Teslas anymore, for at least for this program or the California Vehicle Rebate Project. So interestingly enough, and last year, 30% of the applications were Teslas and 5% were Chevy Bolts. And this year, 31% were Chevy Bolts, and last year, and 5% were Teslas. So this is just the amount of incentives we had per year. This is up to date. So you can see that we have far more applications last year, and that's just a result of the lower incentive amounts and more funding available for the program. We had 400,000 available last year and only 350,000 this year. And then each of the incentives got a larger chunk of the total portion. So we've had a lot of positive responses to the program. It's really helped people that may not have been able to afford an electric vehicle to get into one. We've got a lot of enthusiasm about the program. So I'll leave this up for just a moment so you can read this. our electric bike program. These programs, as of this, during this analysis, they were already completed. So this year's program, when we opened it up on July 1st, it was completed within 6 weeks. So we just went through the money really fast. A total of 131 applicants for both years. Of course, the first year, because it was $1,000 per incentive and we had $50,000, there were 50 incentives. So this year it's was variable because of the $500 for the just a regular applicant, and the low-income applicants had $1,000 available. So total of $100,000 for 2 years. And first application, first year was low income only, but surprisingly, this year we had the majority of our applications were 56% of 56% of the total applicants. So a lot of interest from low income applicants. This is the breakdown by county. Santa Cruz County, by and large, took the lion's share of the incentives. So most of the interest was in Santa Cruz County. And we barely got any interest in San Benito County at all. Although we did do some advertising out there and trying to get do some outreach to get people interested. So 82%, we do run a survey when we, through the application system. So we require a survey to be filled out as part of the application. And so we did collect some of this information about which ones needed incentives or not. And so 82% of the applicants stated that they needed the incentive to afford to purchase an e-bike for the 2 years. 67% though were low income and stated they needed the incentive. So not all low income needed the incentive to get the, to buy the e-bike, so, which was kind of surprising to me, but majority of the people do need the incentive to get into an e-bike. And 56% said that they were displacing the use of a gasoline powered vehicle, which is the whole point of the program, I think. So this is some of the testimonials from a couple of the applicants. They were just really overjoyed to have the funding that helped them get into the bike. And what's interesting about these are that these are people that have physical challenges, and it helped them to get out into the community more, do some errands, run some errands, and just get some exercise. So it's positive from that end as well. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Matthew.
Yeah, thank you for the presentation. I guess maybe a two-part question. One, is there an expectation to continue the split, as it were, of funds with 50,000 going to e-bikes and the remainder going to vehicles for the next fiscal year? Is that the expectation?
We take this back to the board in March. Actually, it will be the April board meeting next year, and so it gets renewed by the board, and we base recommendations on annually. So it's not we're not limited to just the 50,000. We do have a limited amount of funding overall, because these funds come from the DMV fees that we collect from the local, everybody's registration in the region on their vehicles. So if the advisory committee has some recommendations on, we will bring the program back to, so the AB 2766 program comes back to the advisory committee for review and suggestions and guidance. And so if the advisory committee has some guidance, then we could start looking at that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think this would be a great discussion item either now or at any time in the future before that April meeting, to maybe talk about what's the appropriate share of those funds Obviously, you know, there's a push for alternative modes of transportation, which would, of course, have more of those funds go towards e-bikes. But, you know, we want to get also a lot of gas cars off the road. So I don't know the answer to that per se, but I do think it's a great discussion to have.
Yeah, I do want to actually add that there are other programs that we're stacking on. And so the state of California is coming out with a program here in the not too distant future. And Central Coast Community Energy has also had a program. And so these are, we do have to be, and the city of Santa Cruz as well. So we have to be careful about, you know, if they're stacked so much that the purchase of a, someone will get actually paid to get an electric bicycle. So we have to be careful about that. So there's ways that, you know, this is something we have to look at and what else is out there and try to format the program to what's the existing environment for that.
Well, then in that case, I think it'd be great if this was outlined on the upcoming agenda, if any of that information was known from those other jurisdictions to be brought to add to that conversation. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Okay. Lacey?
Yeah, I'd like to build on Matt's comments because I agree. Based on this presentation, which thank you for, and just the lower environmental impact of e-bikes versus electric vehicles, you know, from cradle to cradle, so to speak, or cradle to grave in some cases, I would potentially support that we move some funding, additional funding into e-bikes. But it also makes me wonder, David, since you said, you know, there's all these different pots that people might be able to pull from, and especially for low income folks that might be interested, you know, especially in if they can get the entire thing reimbursed, that's great. Obviously, we don't want to give away extra free money. But making it really easy, because I think sometimes the process, especially if it's a new process and you're not sort of familiar with what forms are or where to go to look for this money. But if that's streamlined, and maybe it is already, say, you can go to this agency and get this fund, but working with those other agencies so it's one application, you know, and then it's sort of a shared pot or something. I know these things are harder, easier said than done, but I think if we really want to support, especially low income folks getting these bikes, making the process as smooth as possible, multi-language, you know, multilingual, all of that would be really beneficial. And I think it's Ecology Action. You know, most of these had higher numbers in Santa Cruz, and they did a big push for a campaign, EVs para todos and EVs for everyone. And I don't know if they worked with you at all on that, or if you saw that have any sort of impact in getting folks more interested in the campaign. But
we did see that we had a lot more low-income applicants, and I don't have any stats really on that, but we did see that year to year. And I think that's why we doubled the low-income applications for the electric vehicle incentive program, is because of EVs para todos. And that was a grant that Ecology Action had received from Electrify America to do outreach and assistance programs for low-income areas and disadvantaged communities. And so we were working with Ecology Action to help, you know, we provided letters of support for them to get into that program. So we were glad that you know, they received that. And I think it did help get more. And I think the indicators are that, yeah, we did get more low-income applicants. And we also saw more of the used vehicles that were being applied for. And so, and we dealt directly with Michael Saint and others at Ecology Action on the on this program. So we were interacting with them directly and getting low-income applicants part of the program.
Great.
That's we also good. We also shifted the way we determined low-income applicants as well. So we were used to just go through the Central Coast Energy Services to determine a low-income applicant. So it ended up being a hurdle to determine what was low-income. Mm-hmm. And we did shift last year from just doing the HEAP applicants or LIHEAP to opening it up to WIC and CARE and other programs that were low income based. And so I think that opened the door for a lot more low income applicants.
Do you know, I'm sorry, I just have, Eric, do you mind if I just ask one more thing quick? Okay, thank you. I understand that there was, I think a regional organization that had been working with on developing legislation that would sort of shift how low income might be able to purchase EVs or e-bikes. And that would be to give a almost like a debit card that could be only used at specific locations for specific things. Because they identified a hurdle that, yeah, they can get this reimbursement, but a lot of times they don't even have the money up front to purchase the bikes. Have you heard if that's moved forward at all, or if that will have an impact in future?
I haven't heard of that. I know that is a limitation for low-income applicants. The challenge is for them to find a down payment or money up front. And we've in our experience, especially with our Woodstow changeout program, where we've had these programs where we do a voucher type program rather than a rebate type program, is that we have to have a specific retailers that we have agreements with that they'll sell the bike and then carry the loan essentially until the air district can pay them. And it makes it really challenging.
Yeah.
And, you know, because we'll pay them within, you know, maybe 30 days after we have all the paperwork together. Mm-hmm. So it could be, you know, it depending on, you know, when we get the paperwork, it could be a couple months out. So these small retailers are carrying thousands of dollars of cost of, you know, to them, and they just aren't banks. And so it makes it really difficult. And if someone else can carry those funds until we can reimburse them, then that would be workable. So that solution sounds great. If there's somebody else that is doing that, then with a debit card, then sure. Mm-hmm. But I haven't heard of that program. Do you know the name of that? Or
not off the top of my head, but I can find out and let you know.
Yeah, if you could send me an email on that, I'd be really interested in finding out more about that. Because that is a real challenge for us. And it's one of the main, I think, limitations for low-income applicants.
Okay. Yeah, I'll let you know.
Eric?
Great discussion. I love the data from the bikes about how many people are replacing a car with it and everything like that. Do we also have data from people who received the car incentive about whether they would have bought a car without it and if they are getting another car or if they're replacing a gas one and all that stuff?
We have that. I didn't present it to you this time. I can get that data though.
No, it's all good. I was just thinking in the future in terms of deciding how to apportion the funds, thinking about replacement and thinking about sort of how much you're inducing demand would be interesting.
Yeah, it is. And I think we definitely want people that don't need the incentive to just step away from the program.
Yeah, totally.
You know, so, but that's hard. It's available to them and they'll take it. So it may be that the program just goes to low-income applicants, and that might be another solution. So but we'll definitely bring this back to the advisory committee before we bring it to the board, and so you have a chance to comment on it.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, we will go to the air pollution control officer's report. Rich?
Great. Thanks, Janet. Try to make this pretty quick. You should have received a copy of my notes. I'll just start off with remote meetings. We mentioned that, but we're probably going to go to having in-person meetings in the future unless something drastically changes. So there is a potential for that. In engineering compliance,
we have a new Senate Bill 1137, which imposes new requirements in oil and gas operations in the state. And this is the California Geologic Energy Management Division, used to be known as DOGGER. Don't ask me what that, the Department of Geothermal something gas development, but they've got a new regulation out there, and we'll be following up and probably working and incorporating that with our oil and gas regulation that we're doing for CARB at the moment. We also have a request out for proposals to help us set up an electronic data transfer for our database. We download data to the Environmental Protection Agency on compliance. And so we're looking to get some of our database information to talk to their database. I think this is remaining open. We haven't had any applicants yet. Also, this is a standing item that's on the board meeting, but we're sort of the clearinghouse for complaints in the marina area relative to odors. And we know what the sources are. We just don't know who's doing it at what time, but there's a landfill, there's a wastewater treatment plant, there's a digester there, or where was, and there's composting operations and agriculture. And each of those has a role that is played in generating odors and emissions. So the city of Marina has actually did their own RFP, and they're hiring a consultant to look into a source apportionment and look into where the odors may be coming from. We think that that's probably a pretty large task to take a bite out of. We're not sure they're going to be successful with the limited amount of money they have, but we're advising where we can. And then this one, this has been on our radar for a while now. The state right now, a lot of people are stepping up and trying to use air curtain incinerators. These are devices that are look like a tractor trailer rig, and they have a fan that goes over the top and recirculates the emissions from the fire. So they burn forestry products and waste products and wood waste. And looks like CAL FIRE has started operating a number of these things. They are huge sources of emissions. We're talking about NOx and other emissions. They're pretty good at reducing smoke because they have this boundary layer of air, hence the name, that goes over and recirculates it inside the combustion chamber. But these things are so massive in emissions that they typically require a federal Title V permit. In addition, EPA has a source performance standards for them, and CAL FIRE has been oblivious to those. It's one of those political things where we'd probably rather see them use this device, but we'd like to know in advance if they're going to use it rather than just do burn piles. So this is another example of intensive CO2 emissions that are coming out of these things because they are combustion. But, you know, compared to a forest fire, they're a drop in the bucket. So this has been a very difficult situation to navigate. So we've got our work cut out for us, much like with the ag community, to work with fire agencies on getting these things permitted. And same time, EPA is taking a track to perhaps withdraw their requirement that these things receive a Title V air operating permit. So I'm sure we'll be telling you more. Along those lines too, as was mentioned, and I wasn't going to mention this, but we had a meeting with several supervisors last week about biochar, and we're big supporters. We've actually contributed money to biochar research projects, one of them being in San Luis Obispo. That's basically where you basically char materials, biomaterials, and you don't combust them, but you basically turn them into charcoal, and then they can use that as soil amendment. It has no nutritional value, but it helps with water retention, and the wineries are very much interested in this, so they dig trenches and put the stuff in. And so there's a proposal underway we expect to see submitted to us that will be taking in biosolids from the landfill out at Marina. So that may be a project worth keeping track of, and we'll certainly let this committee know if anything moves forward. We've had a lot of proposals in the past about gasification and pyrolysis and all these new technologies that are supposedly being used in Europe and elsewhere in Japan. And if I had a dollar for each of those projects that were proposed and never followed through on, we'd probably be pretty wealthy. So we hope this one is successful. This is a way to sequester carbon that's put directly back into the earth. It actually has a negative impact if you can get enough materials, but this thing will also be a drop in the bucket relative to the amount of material, biomaterial that's being produced at the landfill. So, but that is something that could go out to, for instance, we did see some ag operations bring a biochar field burning on their site, and they were able to put that material back into the land. So interesting things, and we're definitely supportive of those things, but we're also suspicious because we want to make sure, as Janet said earlier, that these things are documentable and that we can really feel fairly confident that they're reducing CO2 or sequestering carbon. In our planning and air monitoring, we've pretty much gone through all of our air stations and updated them with computers from old data loggers and data devices. We have one station remaining, and that may be already upgraded by the writing of this document. So we're really sort of turning to the future for improvements in our air monitoring technology. And this goes to a comment Lacey made, and you'll hear this from me all the time. I act like a business. We don't have a lot of time to be inefficient in the job we do. So we've done a lot as far as automation and enhancements at our air monitoring sites to reduce the amount of time we're spending at those leased personnel time, because that's costly to us. And same thing about giving money away. We need to have a source of money to be able to run these programs. And David's group has been really successful at putting together online automated systems to grab information through the application process and so forth for the incentive program. So we're doing everything we can to be as efficient and as effective as possible. And then lastly, I just wanted to let you know, we've hired a new air quality planner, and his name is Eli Lessman. And he comes from us from actually, he was at environmental scientist at the California Department of Food, Agriculture in California. But prior to that, he was a research assistant at Columbia University, and he got his BS in biology and biochemistry from Brooklyn College, and his master's in toxicology and environmental health science from Columbia University. And he started a few weeks back, and he seems like a really great guy. And we're also currently recruiting for a supervising planner in that program as well. But we haven't had a lot of hits or applicants. So it's been sort of hit and miss on the recruitment side. And we have a number of openings that we're foreseeing. In addition, we have a number of retirements that will be taking place over the next several months. So we're going to be pretty much full-time recruiting. And then lastly, I just wanted to mention that, and this goes back to some of the I think what Lacey was talking about, Ecology Action did put on EV ride, drive, and display event, Salinas. It was very successful. We contributed money towards that. We had a booth there. David even got on the evening news, so that was really great. But we saw that there were about 80 test drives of EVs. We had over 500 attendees, and they had these passports where they had to go around, and I guess you got a prize for whoever got the greatest visitation at booths and so forth. So we typically do at least one of those types of events each year. COVID-19 sort of threw that off, but we actually had a really successful ride and drive event here at the office. We even brought out, taco trucks, and we had, balloons and stuff. And it was a very a carnival-like atmosphere, and it was very successful. So we're still trying to get the word out about electric vehicles and about infrastructure. And we hope to continue that going forward. And if we get additional dollars, we could look into trying to bolster those programs, but it's been a sort of a balancing act with trying to spend money on infrastructure as well as the electric vehicles themselves. It's been very exciting, and I know that Community Power has done a lot of vehicle incentives, and they're actually putting in a lot of installations for infrastructure as well. So we're getting there. We're by no means as have as much investment as say the Bay Area, but they've got a lot of people and resources up there. So that concludes my report. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Richard, could you explain the biochar thing again? I would like to know, does it have an impact on water supply as well?
Yeah, that's actually the twofer for this is that, so basically they create charcoal and it's not through a combustion process. It's sort of they greatly warm the carbon and turn it into a charcoal-like structure. So there's no flame typically associated with it. However, this device they're showing us shows that they have warming emissions, which we think is they generate somewhat, they call it a synthetic gas, and they use that to heat the device so that it warms up the material and basically bakes it to a carbon state. And that sequesters the carbon. It's no longer, it looks like charcoal and it crumbles really easily. And they put that as a soil amendment into the earth, and the wineries like it because it helps with water retention. I mean, I suppose if you go through the whole life cycle analysis, they have to have probably diesel tractors dig these huge trenches where the root structures are and all that. But and then you have trucks that are driving the stuff all around. But it's it's in the car has it as in approved. There's protocols for it to approve it as a carbon sequestration protocol or a project. So it looks like, it's something that could be definitely used, but there's a lot of questions that remain. Like we still don't know what emissions are associated with this particular project. We do know some of the field burning operations, and I say burning, it's not really burning, it's just warming the materials to the point where they carbonize. They create a lot of heat, but they don't create a lot of smoke. And that material on site can be turned back into the soil. And once again, as I said, the beauty supposedly, and we're not soil scientists here, but is that it helps with soil moisture retention.
I'm on the board of directors of the Salinas Valley Basin JSA. And I am really interested in the aspect of that in terms of reducing water consumption. If you could send me any information you have on that, certainly. I would appreciate it.
Certainly, yeah. I know that a number of wineries down there have already used this the material for that purpose.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Seeing no questions, we will go on to future agenda items. I think we have the electric bicycle program on a future agenda item. Are there any other suggestions? Seeing none, I'll go on. I have no comments as a chair. Are there comments from the committee members? Seeing none, I will adjourn the meeting. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks, everyone. Happy holidays.
Thank you.
Same to you.